It's morning, 20 miles from the enemy. These are American boys going to work. The morning fighter patrol. They're flying over Italy, and there are others like them flying over Burma, over the coast of Holland, over China, and over Germany. In search of the enemy. Enemy planes. The odds are bad this morning. Nearly 3-1. The routine morning patrol goes on. They close the range. 3,500 feet. 3,000. 2,500. 2,000. The odds are still 3-1. But it's three Nazis spinning down in blood and flame to every one of ours.
You can't judge a man here by the color of his eyes or the shape of his nose. On the flight strip, you judge a man by the way he flies. Here's the answer to Adolf and Hirohito. Here's the answer. Wings for this man. Here's the answer. Wings for these Americans. Squadron after squadron out of Tuskegee, flying P-40s first, tough little planes, then striking with Thunderbolts, P-47s, then riding the Mustangs, P-51s. No, it was never easy for these men. They were pioneers, and no pioneer has it easy. They fought lies, they fought heartbreak, and they won. Now they fight the enemy. On his own soil.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Yes, we hope you like us when we're angry. I'm Dean Karyanis.
And I'm Owen Mugen. Welcome back to the Angry History Show.
You just heard a clip from 1945's Wings for This Man. And you may have recognized the narrator there as Ronald Reagan, then an actor, of course, during World War II. The U.S. Army Air Force's first motion picture unit produced that propaganda film about the Tuskegee Airmen, the first African-American pilots in the U.S. military.
That's right. And today we're going to introduce you to a living legend from that group. He is Colonel Charles E. McGee, born in 1919, and our most distinguished fighter pilot, with 6,308 flying hours under his belt. Grew up in Illinois and reached the rank of Eagle Scout. He says, quote, "If everyone lived by the Scout oath and laws, we could reduce our police force and we would be quite a nation of people," end quote.
Yeah, he's a pretty great guy, and he really cares about young people, and he wants to set an example. I mean, he's in his 90s now. I mean, think about it, born in 1919, you know.
Yeah,
he could hit 100 with a stone, basically, right now.
Yeah. Just for context, that's 2 years after President Kennedy was born.
Wow. I never thought of it that way. By the way, he was born on December 7th, so it was his birthday when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. He was on his way to church to sing. He was in a glee club, and his life changed like they did for so many men back then.
It's true. It's interesting you say that about his birthday being Pearl Harbor Attack Day. We have friends whose birthdays are September 11th, you know, and it's interesting to see them even 13 years down. Is it 13 already? My goodness. Down the road of having it just being such an impactful day for them. But of course, not as many of them signed up.
Yeah, true. Well, Colonel McGee at the time, you know, he's a young man, obviously. He knew that he might get drafted. He talks about that. But he would go on to serve not only in World War II, but also Korea and Vietnam. And he holds the U.S. Air Force record with 409 fighter combat missions.
Wow.
And when you think of those, again, we can't relate to it. Most of us here, like you and I mean, he would go up. They were up there for 5 hours. I mean, this was escorting bombers. Some were as long as six long flights.
Yep.
He said the cockpit feels really small up there, and you might sweat through a leather flight jacket, for example. I mean, you're up in the sun, right? There's obviously no shade.
That's crazy.
But it wasn't easy or even possible for men like him to enlist that first day of the attacks.
Routine morning patrol. They're good planes, wonderful planes. And their pilots are good, too. Listen.
Yesterday, I fulfilled one of my ambitions as a combat pilot. I got one airplane.
An American far from home, fighting a war around the world. Listen again.
This was my leader, and the second ship was me, and two Focke-Wulfs came on my right. I turned right and put up a stone wall of bullets, and the first...
A wall of bullets. It wasn't so long ago these men were students in a university, workmen in a shipyard. just plain citizens from everywhere USA. They changed jobs, they changed clothes. They took a train into the future. They didn't know what the future would be, but many hoped they'd get the chance to fly and fight in the air. Some wanted that chance more than anything in the world.
Pilots got the opportunity to prove their mettle in the 99th Pursuit Squadron, which grew into the 332nd Fighter and 477th Bombardment Group at the Tuskegee Institute. The trip to Alabama was Colonel McGee's first real experience in the South. For instance, he said, quote, as the train left Southern Illinois, you had to change your location in the car. You know what, I bet, you know, all the stuff that he faced, and it makes me think, I wonder what happened if you made Colonel McGee angry. He would just blow you out of the sky.
Yeah, he'd hop right in his plane and take care of you, yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little bit more about the Tuskegee Institute.
Deep inside Alabama is a famous school called the Tuskegee Institute. It was founded on July 4th of 1881. And since that Independence Day, it has graduated many thousands into agriculture, into science, into industry. This school was the first of its kind, and its founder, Booker T. Washington, was a pioneer who broke open a road for others to follow. This man had a dream, and the dream became stone. He lifted the veil of ignorance from his people and pointed the way to progress through education and industry. Close to this school, close to the work this man had done, the United States government determined to build an airfield. 3 years ago, this was just another farm in Alabama. More than trees had to be cleared away. There was misunderstanding and distrust and prejudice to be cleared away. 3 years ago, there was only an idea. But ideas are powerful things. And today, there are fighter planes flying overhead. Instead of swamp and yellow pine, there are hangars, repair shops, barracks. Instead of patches of corn, concrete flight strips. But that's not enough. You can't make a fighter squadron out of concrete and aluminum and a can of paint. It takes men. A chemistry student, a welder, a shoe salesman must learn how to fly. A group of average Americans must become a team of fighting men with wings.
Now let's get the man himself, Colonel McGee. He spoke at Kansas City's Public Library, the Central Branch, and they were kind enough to make this audio available. He started by explaining the official U.S. government policy between the wars.
I want to read something to you, because in 1925, this is a memorandum for the Chief of Staff. Folks, this is an Air War College, Army Air War College study. And the subject is use of Negro manpower in war. We were called Negro back at that time frame. They have a lot of references, but paragraph 2 says the problem presented. So it was a problem to them that 10% of America's population, 10% of America's population was a problem. Facts bearing on the problem. The Negro is physically qualified for combat duty, but he is by nature subservient and believes himself to be inferior to the white man. He is most susceptible to the influence of crowd psychology. He cannot control himself in the fear of danger to the extent the white man can. He has not the initiative and resourcefulness of the white man. Oh, he is mentally inferior to the white man. And they have a reference for that. I haven't studied that reference. Let me jump over to what they concluded. Because of what they thought, or what they considered a problem, they said, yes, if America gets involved in another war, we need to use that one-tenth of the population. But hey, we got roads to build, ditches to dig, food to cook, but not in a technical area. And oh, by the way, blacks and whites cannot work together successfully. Therefore, they'll have to be in separate units. And oh, because of their inferior quality, they'll have to operate under white leadership in separate units. Let me read two things more here. It is recommended that this study be taken as the basic policy of the War Department for the use of Negro manpower. The policies and plan for the use of Negro manpower proposed in this study are a combination of several years' study by the faculty and student body of the Army War College. Folks, that became Army policy.
Funny you listen to the man speak. And of course, I can't get it out of my head. I wish I could ask him some questions so I could go, Colonel McGee! Colonel McGee! but just to hear it's almost a sense of amusement in his voice when he talks about the insane racial policies at the time. Graceful is one way to put it. And put it this way, he's been there. We haven't. There's no way, I can certainly understand the man's struggle and his struggle to want to defend his nation.
You'll hear Colonel McGee refer to this as the Tuskegee Experiment, and we wanted to say it's not to be confused with the infamous Tuskegee Syphilis Experiment run for 40 years starting in 1932. That clinical study, run by the U.S. government with help from the Institute, built upon a Norwegian clinical trial. In it, hundreds of poor African-American sharecroppers suffering from the disease were observed, fed, and given basic medical care, but they were never told that they had syphilis. That led to them passing the bacteria on to their wives and thereby to some of their children. Even when penicillin provided a cure for syphilis, the men weren't treated. President Clinton issued a formal apology for the study in 1997, and we changed the way that we do clinical trials to more respect people as human beings and not just subjects.
Now, let's move on a little bit here. When Benjamin Oliver Davis Jr. sought to change the Army policy, his name carried a lot of weight, actually. His father was Benjamin O. Davis Sr. He was our first African-American general, serving in the Spanish-American War, Philippine War, and both World Wars. Now, here's how the younger Davis literally got the Tuskegee Airmen off the ground. Let's give a listen.
In 1936, a young man named B.O. Davis Jr. graduated from West Point and said, I want to be a pilot. They told him no. He couldn't go to school because they had no black units, so he as a black officer would have no place to go, so they're not going to train him in aviation. 1939, war clouds in Europe. America's got to rebuild itself. War industry taking place. And, of course, folks were coming out of 10 years of depression, so everybody's interested in jobs and opportunities that would be taking place. But they formed a civilian pilot training program at colleges around the country. This would give us a pool of pilots that our military units could draw on to provide for whatever capability we would prepare to send to Europe. Initially, that program didn't include black colleges, but of course, interest around enough, they finally, six of the so-called black colleges had the program. But pilots getting their license in the small aircraft, some going next door to the Army and saying, I want to be an Army pilot. What'd the policy say? They applied the policy. They said, no, we can't use a black pilot. We have no black mechanics. Well, pressure stayed on, and the Army said, well, we've studied the issue. It's going to fail, but you keep asking for it. We'll authorize A squadron. We'll authorize the 99th Pursuit Squadron. What's a squadron at that time? 30 pilots, 24 aircraft. Looked at the fine print, said, and all of the necessary support. Well, folks, that's a couple hundred technicians, in other words, and the armors and the engine mechanics and those that actually work on the aircraft and get it in there. And then there's, all of the support? Well, we need medical, and we need administration, we need communications, we need supply. Another almost a couple hundred folks. So for that one squadron, they got trained. Now, this is a pilot program. But the Army, because of their policy saying we can't use black pilots and two have mechanics, the program was actually started at Chanute Field, Round 2, Illinois, training the mechanics for the program. And that's where I, as a student at the University of Illinois, heard about this experiment. Well, I had a draft card, and I knew what infantry might be like, and so... and I wasn't sure, although I was interested in engineering, to want to be a mechanic, so I signed up for the pilot side of the program, went and passed the exams, and was accepted, and... Well, I was accepted in April of 42, but what happened? Well, mechanics are getting trained. Got to provide for pilot training. Ooh. Whites are at all these airfields all around the country, so they found $4 million to build a separate airfield. 9 miles from Tuskegee, Alabama, they built, began the building of Tuskegee Army Airfield, and the pilot training began in 1941. Mechanics coming down from Chanute joined up with the pilots in 42. That first class had 12 cadets and one student officer. Now, I think you all know who that student officer was. B.O. Davis, Jr., who was turned down in 1936.
B.O. Davis, Jr. went on to be the Air Force's first African-American general officer and retired with 4 stars. But no one knew that was his destiny when the 99th got their first taste of combat.
The 99th Squadron, with its support, was combat ready in December of 1942. And that was the time that I started my first flight, having finally been called up after waiting several months earlier in the year. But the 99th, being combat ready, the Army had a problem. What white commander is going to take a black unit? You got a name? Anybody tell me? Nobody. So they sent the 99th to North Africa attached to the 33rd Fighter Group. Did they go to the 33rd base? No, they went to their own base with their support, all of their support, and began operation. They would send a pilot over to the 33rd location, get their briefing, come back, fly their mission. But Colonel Mohmeyer, we need to talk about attitude. Colonel Mohmeyer didn't want them, so his reports reflected his attitude. Now, they're not aggressive. They've only, over several months, only shot down one aircraft. They're not real strong in their togetherness. And, well, recommend they go patrol Liberia. Look at your map, folks. Where were the Germans in North Africa? And where is Liberia? Well, that was their recommendation. He did not say that their bombs on Pantelleria and their movement into Sicily, pushing the Germans out of Sicily and Italy, was equal to what everybody else was doing. But that's the way it happened. Well, we have to give you another phase of the story and come back to the 99th portion, that first phase of the Tuskegee experience. 99th's going to need replacements. Can't sign a white pilot there. So training continued at Tuskegee Army Airfield. And 3 additional fighter squadrons came out of that training, the 100th, the 301st, and 302nd, that became the 332nd Fighter Group. Combat ready in the P-40 like the 99th, but, oh, mission did change. You're going to fly the P-39 Bell Air Cobra. We did a little more left, still combat ready, and went directly to Italy in 1944. The time that we went to Italy was about the time that another phase of the 99th experience comes into play, because as they moved out of Sicily into Italy, they were assigned to the 79th Fighter Group. I mentioned attitude. Colonel Bill Bates said, fine, I've got more pilots to do the job. And if there's any early integration that took place under Colonel Bill Bates, as he, with the 99th flying with them, supporting the Anzio beachhead landing, 99th pilots shot down 17 German aircraft in 7 or 8 day time frame. Again, doing the job. But later, 99th was moved back to attachment to the 33rd. And Bill Bates's approach was forgotten. I don't know whether he ever got promoted in the Army, though.
The amazing thing throughout this story is just how hard they had to fight simply to risk their lives. And it reminds me of a story of Theodore Roosevelt. He went to the White House when Woodrow Wilson was running the Great War, and he asked for permission to raise a new Rough Riders regiment to deploy in France. And when Wilson didn't jump at the offer, keep in mind TR's blind in one eye by now, and he's 59 years, and he's been ravaged by his trip to Brazil, Roosevelt doesn't understand, and he told Colonel Edward M. House, quote, "I don't understand. After all, I'm only asking to be allowed to die," unquote, to which House replied, "Oh, did you make that point quite clear to the president?"
That's excellent. This is actually an interesting thing that seems to run through in the Roosevelt family, at least as far as T.R. And his children go. I mean,
wasn't Theodore Roosevelt Jr.
not in really good shape at all in the Second World War? And he sort of, I don't know, bullied his way into the Normandy beach landing is a way to put it. But I mean, he was in terribly ill health, right?
Yeah, he was. He'd had a heart attack. He was having heart attacks before. He was the oldest man and the highest ranking man to go ashore. Ted, as he was called, was played by Henry Fonda in the movie The Longest Day, a favorite of ours.
We named a brunch after it.
That sounds so manly compared to TR. Talking about a man who just had two heart attacks going on Normandy Beach with a cane.
We named a brunch after it. Oh, man. Hey, you know what? I am committed to whatever sort of happens in this show. You know what? I could have just edited this out, but instead you're here.
No, it'll stay in.
So, yeah. All right.
So, yes, Owen named a brunch after it.
And, now it says Owen who named a brunch after it. Okay, but go ahead.
Yeah, and actually at the bar right across from the Ghostbusters firehouse.
That's right.
Henry Fonda wears a helmet in that as Theodore Roosevelt Jr. And one of the facts is that Theodore Roosevelt Jr. didn't wear a helmet at Normandy. And they landed wrong. You know, the tides were notoriously rough in the English Channel. And he was the one who said, "We'll start the war from right here." And he went and he was rallying guys, no helmet, this old man. I mean, you picture yourself an 18, 19, 20-year-old guy, the age, you know, of Colonel McGee, and you see this old man and he's a Roosevelt. You're going to get rallied and want to go for it. And he really did help rally the troops that day. And again, without a helmet. So Henry Fonda shouldn't have been wearing one. Small detail.
No, it's true for accuracies. No, but hey, you know what? Things hinge on these. All right. Next, Colonel McGee answers a question about how the pilots mentally prepared themselves to go on those combat missions. Let's give a listen. This is really cool.
Fortunately, even though the Army expected the program to fail, they didn't change the standards. We had excellent training. We were prepared for the type of task that we would face. And of course, we individually want to be accepted for how we perform. So, hey, where do you set the standard? Mine was always do your best in whatever you're doing, and that helped along the way. There are 10 years I always feel that prepare everybody for their future. In the time frame we were talking about, the country, and I think I may have mentioned it, came out of 10 years of depression. So what were the attitudes? Everybody was eager. We were, even though there was segregation, we were more American to do the jobs in the plants, to better ourselves, and so on. Kind of not out front focus, but yet a push that everybody was moving in the same direction and essentially for the same reason. Now, I fell in love with aviation, and I tell young folks, I hope everybody prepares themselves and finds a job they enjoy doing, because I don't think there's anything better than going to work every day and liking what you're doing. So I enjoyed, I made mine a military career. Now I do have to say that in the late 50s when I might have aspired to become an airline pilot, well, they just weren't ready. So I stayed in the military. But yeah, it took some lawsuits in the early 60s, as you know, for them to begin to give folks equal access.
Yeah, you talk about a fight that just continued and continued and continued. And he's absolutely right about, goodness, being able to be in a position of liking or loving what you do, you know, to bring the money in, to put the food on the table for your family. I mean, it's quite a unique thing. And gosh, especially now in our day and age, man, oh man, isn't that hard to
do? It's really an inspiring story that he has and the way that he tells it. And, you know, he doesn't need to be out there talking to people. He has a ton of accolades. He's done his service, but he really wants to bring his story and ask other people to help keep it alive. So, you know, us with our whatever little bit that we can do, we were happy to be able to bring it to people and just share it, because it's completely different than what you would think, especially, I mean, the movies don't always hit the mark or you know, and so.
Well, no, by design.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and we'll talk about that a little later, but at this point in the story, the pilots are over the North African theater, and this is where their P-51 Mustangs, which Colonel McGee still names as his favorite plane, got the paint jobs that would mark them throughout history.
Colonel McGee explained the origin of the Red Tails this way, quote, "As I understand it, red paint was what was readily available. I think on the first couple of planes they just painted the rudder, but one of the pilots in the 332nd said, that's not enough. As it turned out, the gunners on the Boeing B-17s and the consolidated B-24s loved it because they could easily tell who was friendly at high altitude over the target area," end quote. Makes a lot of sense.
The 332nd fighter group became the Red Tails. It was important that in the escort work, number one, you wanted to be clearly identifiable so that the gunners on those bombers didn't have you in their sights instead of a German aircraft. And then also we pilots didn't want to have one of our own aircraft in our gun sights. And so we became the Red Tails. One of the other units was the Candy Stripes. Somebody else had checkerboard. We had that identification for those purposes. Well, I can say right here that Army policy had still never changed, so many of the bomber pilots did not know that Red Tails were black pilots. And if somebody tells you, oh, yeah, the plane flew by there, and I recognize them, you got a helmet on, goggles, and oxygen mask. Well, you can understand that.
The Red Tails shot down over 100 of the enemy in the war. Now, Colonel McGee says that by looking at the pilots in the cockpit with all the gear and the mask, you couldn't tell what they looked like. But during the Q&A this day at the Kansas City Library, a fellow veteran stood up and revealed that he, too, had been in the Italian theater during the war, and he could tell who was flying the planes.
Colonel, I'd like to thank you for an excellent program. Enjoyed it thoroughly. But I also want to thank you for your work in Italy in 1944. You see, I was one of those bomber pilots. I got shot down, but not by enemy aircraft. It was by anti-aircraft guns. I also like to say that that may have been a secret, but as far as the two pilots on our bomber, we knew those were black pilots up there. And we were happy to have them up there. We'd have liked to have a few more. I like to say that it was rather difficult to keep a secret when we bomber pilots could listen to the radio and we find that somewhere or another some enemy aircraft were after a bomber. The pilot wanted some help and he called for some help, and you hear over the radio the reply that comes back. Sounded a great deal like Rochester of Jack Benny fame. Said, "Yes, sir, boss, coming right down."
Yeah, well, I guess Rochester was a frame of reference. I mean, he could have said Amos or Andy.
Yeah, I think that would have been the insult part. But yeah, the thing is, a lot of these guys came from all over, and now it sounds so terrible. But you think about it, being segregated in schools and so much of life, of course people are going to pick up different dialects and speak different way. I mean, regionally then, too, you didn't have any of the common TV shows and whatnot. But Colonel McGee obviously gets a laugh out of it. That's something you wouldn't think of unless you hear it from the source that, oh, right, these guys were using the radio. And sometimes maybe, you wouldn't know. I'm sure, I mean, Colonel McGee, obviously growing up in Illinois, didn't have that accent. But, some people, I'm sure you would be able to tell. That's why there's always a guy in every World War II movie named Brooklyn, right, Owen?
That's exactly right. It's true. By now, they'd had their missions, and they were recording themselves as good or better than any other fighter group. So instead of being exiled to Liberia, the 332nd found themselves in Italy, the underbelly of Hitler's fortress Europe. And remember, that required moving all the support staff, who also had to be African-American.
The 332nd was flying Naples Harbor and Coastal Patrol up to the Anzio beachhead. And when in April, our bombers, now located in southern Italy, there to destroy Germany's war-making potential, were taking very heavy losses as they fly deep into German defended territory. And I think if you know the history, sometimes half of the squadron didn't get back home. They needed escort. And so 12th Tactical Air Force released units to form the 15th Strategic Air Force. And the 332nd Fighter Group was one of four groups picked to begin the support service of our B-17s and B-24s. We moved from the Naples area of Italy to the Adriatic side and began, as I say, with P-47 Thunderbolt. We had the P-47 for only about 3 months of early July, 44. All of the escort units were flying the P-51 Mustang. And let me pause this here and say, sometimes, you know, folks always like to talk to the pilots. We pilots do our thing, and it's real great. But folks, the unsung heroes are the guys that made it possible. We often forget about the mechanics and the technicians that did that. And here, these mechanics had no prior experience other than their schooling at Chanute Field. But in combat, we switched from the P-39 to the P-47, P-51, and didn't lose a day. You know, back in that day, you read the tech order, you sat in the cockpit and found where the switches were, and if the mechanic had started, that's my feeling, I'll go fly. That's part of the story.
I always think of my grandfather, who I'd never met, who served at NZO. He's one of these guys who was, you know, he was FOB, fresh off the boat in 37, from Ireland to Brooklyn, and then signed up, take a big fat guess when, and then, you know, came back an American. So, fascinating stuff.
Here's a response to the legend that the Tuskegee Airmen never, and that's the key word, never, lost a bomber, so pilots wouldn't fly with anyone else. And we just heard a bomber there express, you know, that these were good pilots and he wished he had more of them. Over time, I think any story is going to get embellished or, as sure. It's usually the case with the Tuskegee Airmen, talked down. But I love this kind of thing because you go right to the source, and a young woman had asked him about it, and so he answered this question, is it true?
I'm glad you brought that subject up. First of all, folks, when you use the term never, you've got to qualify it. Somebody said that to Colonel Davis when he was there. So neat, you guys have never lost a bomber. That's not a good statement. It would have to be qualified. If you could say in 130 missions you never lost one, you can stand on that. Somebody say in 200 missions, mm-mm. The review of the records shows there were some escort times that bombers were reported lost due to enemy fighters. Now, takes a lot of research. How long is the mission? You're up in the air 4.5, 5, 6 hours. That time frame was 2 hours of that. Where were you? Who was it? There's just lots of questions. The fact does show there, and folks that say never, cut the word out. If you say that the 332nd had a very creditable record, far exceeding what everybody else was doing, you can stand on it.
There's another smaller myth in the HBO movie, The Tuskegee Airmen. It's about Theodore Roosevelt's niece, the first lady at the time, Eleanor Roosevelt.
In the movie, Eleanor Roosevelt goes down to Tuskegee and flies with a cadet. Do you think that would really happen? Eleanor Roosevelt went to Tuskegee on a Rosenwald Fund meeting. And while there, because Tuskegee Institute had a very excellent civilian pilot training program going on, flew with Charles Alfred Anderson. Who was Charles Alfred Anderson? He was a self-taught pilot, got a license in 1932. He headed, when the black universities came in the CPT program, he became a senior instructor at one, and ended up at Tuskegee, and that's who she flew with. She went back to Washington. Well, the story goes that her escort all didn't, don't want to do that, do you? Don't really. They wanted to call the president. You know, the president said, if she wants to fly, she goes to fly. But she went back and did have the influence telling the Army, Chief Anderson flew just like these other pilots that are flying me around. Why are you
dragging your feet to help get that 99th approval.
Eleanor Roosevelt wrote in her April 1st, 1941, My Day column, quote, "These are good pilots. I had the fun of going up in one of the tiny training planes with a head instructor and seeing this interesting countryside from the air," unquote. So she flew with the head instructor, not quite a trainee. And it's also worth noting that Colonel McGee was a technical consultant on the 2012 movie Red Tails.
Yes, which was produced by George Lucas, which had the added bonus of TIE fighters flying over Europe.
I think they just used the sound, right?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, that would be pretty terrifying to...
It would have been. Well, what was it? The Screaming Mimi, right? Those bombs. Hey, those are the deliberately to try to terrify the population.
Yeah, just psychological warfare, destroying people's brains with this stuff. Thursday, May 8th, 1945 brought victory in Europe. And for white airmen, there were victory parades. But take a big fat guess, the Tuskegee Airmen found a very, very different homecoming.
Things hadn't changed here back at home because coming back home, coming down the gangplank, there were still the signs, whites this way, blacks this way. Well, what happened? Those four medium bomb squadrons were 477th Bomb Group Medium. They're training to go to the Pacific. What was their battle? Because, you know, we dropped a big bomb, training stopped, they didn't get the Pacific. But they were fighting the battle here in America to end segregation in the Army training. Because you see, back when they, in 39 and 40, when they were drafting the laws or preparing the laws in Congress for the draft and our participation, they didn't go ask the Army, what's your policy? They said there should be an end of discrimination based on race, creed, or color. But nobody was following that particularly. And the commander, white commander of the base where the 477th units were in training, wanted to keep segregation. Well, you know, Army regulations say officers can use the officers' club, et cetera, et cetera. He, with command approval, said, on my base, trainees will only use the facilities I designate. Well, who was in training? Well, he forgot that there was some... When he said all of the support, it wasn't all in the fighter group. There were other support people who essentially weren't training, but they were black, so they fell under his rule. Well, 101 of the officers were put in jail for trying to enter the officers' club peacefully in twos and threes. In fact, they were shipped off of the base and shipped to Godman Field, Kentucky, put behind barbed wire, and had less freedoms than German prisoners of war at the adjacent Fort Knox. Well, a quick hearing proved that Colonel Selway was wrong, because Army regulations still provide the opportunity. But the war in Europe is over now. The 332nd folks are back. Army still didn't see the light to change their policy. So what could we do?
Well, what they did, of course, was fight it. And that's an amazing story in its own right that is not told. But you were trying to just risk your life. You go up there, you're spending 5 hours in a little sardine can getting shot at, and you maybe don't come back with the same buddies that you went up there with. No. It's heroic listening to one of the heroes of it, but there's plenty of his comrades who got shot down, and maybe you want to go have a drink to one of them, and you got to deal with this crap on the ground. And right. You know, it's almost possible to think that it's comical when you look at it now.
Well, it just seems to defy all sort of threads of logic and sanity, you know, when you do stop and look at it and you look at the sacrifices and, you know, the color that comes pouring out of, you know, any body in an American uniform. It's just weird, man. And, you know, you and I were fortunate enough in a lot of ways to be born when we were born, even though I know you would have preferred to be born somewhere around, you know, the 1850s.
I would have missed McKinley. I'd almost missed McKinley, judging
That's
by
right.
the life
That's
expectancy.
Right. But it's also, you know, you look at things now and yeah, we've got problems. We've got boatloads of them. But the reality on the ground for us growing up, you know, in the New York area, as much as racism absolutely was a factor still, I just couldn't conceive of things being like that. I mean, just for someone to go up and to do all that, to go do this job, this dangerous job, the most dangerous job, and then to just say, okay, you know, sorry, you're black.
Well, so, and there was one thing, know. One interview I read with Colonel McGee, and he talks about flying in Korea. United Nations is there, and they attach them to a South African air wing, I believe. And they asked him, well, if they had apartheid, was that a problem? He's like, no, we had a common enemy, and everything was fine. I never faced it. And he said he never faced it at home in Illinois either. This was until he went down south, that's when he really started facing it. But
right.
So it's to think that the United States policy was more backwards than what we all know and have not personal experience with, but what we all watch, the apartheid. And sure. yet they were willing to give black pilots more of a chance in the 50s than the U.S. was back home before. And it just seems inconceivable right. that it could have been more of an absurd policy than that. I mean, they wouldn't let you get your hair cut or get a drink or do anything. No. Okay.
But wasn't it after Korea? Isn't that when a bunch of Afrikaners built that time machine and brought it back to the 1860s and started supplying the Confederates with automatic weapons? Oh, damn it. That's not real history.
No.
Sorry. That's Harry Truman.
I don't think those are those same guys either. Those were obviously not guys with planes.
No, those are not.
Yeah, they didn't have planes. right. So that was not what the thing was. But not to make light of it, but it's just it's literally seems like it should be something out of a time machine because it's such a strange story. And it's not as if I was saying to Owen before, we didn't have black and white people fighting side by side in our revolution or in our later
right.
wars. I mean, in the
whenever it was
Spanish American War, you know, TR was there. He had the Buffalo soldiers there with him. The next time you see a park ranger, that hat, that's the Buffalo soldiers hat. That's why our U.S.
Right.
park rangers wear it. I mean, people knew yep. that. Look at the picture of Washington crossing the Delaware. There's an African-American man right there behind him on
yeah.
the boat. You know, it was just such a strange thing. I think snowballs. And it's one of those things I think until everybody, a critical mass of people wake up to it. And the war was terrible, but this was their opportunity to show what they could do. And
absolutely. But and this thing, too, you know, and this, I guess, begs a much larger subject that I'm almost hesitant to even verbalize at this point, not in the context of its own show. But you know what? When we have to go to war, we need people to fight the war. And you know, you and I have had these discussions off mic about, you know, we've got strong feelings about how our veterans are treated. It's like, you know what? Let's get them all in there. Let's get them fighting and not worry so much about what happens to them after the war. You know, and I think this is sort of an indicator of that.
Right. That's the attitude,
sort of mindset.
Not our yeah. attitude, but I mean, that's what it seems.
No. That's the attitude. Jeez, no. But I mean, hey, you know what? Rosie of the Riveter, you know, great biceps. Roll your sleeves down. Get back in the kitchen. Same for you, Tuskegee guys. You know,
yeah.
We're not ready to deal with you in an equal fashion once the fighting is stopped.
And they had to continue to fly, though, because they love to fly. And they did it, and they were at least able to do it in a composite group and continue to fight segregation. And this was an effort to achieve what was called the double V. And Colonel McGee explains the origin of that term next.
That phrase came out of the black press because that was our focus at the time. There was discrimination around, and with us going to war, there were those folks that said, hey, blacks participation or Negro participation has two meanings. One, we're fighting to get rid of Nazism in Europe, and number two, hopefully get rid of racism here at home. You see, back then there were still laws on the books in the South that a Negro could be lynched and nobody could do anything about it because it was the way of life. That was the double V. That little action by the 477th pilots who peacefully tried to change the focus with another little fight there in that victory against racism here at home. So it was, as I say, but it started in the black press and was, so we were aware of it because the newspaper and the reporters let us know. And folks, everything doesn't run smoothly like all this went just very nice. Because at that time, I mentioned Congress had passed a law with the draft that there should be equal opportunity based on race, creed, or color.
See, this is interesting. Now, thanks to their service, they now had powerful allies, you know, comrades like that bomber we heard from earlier, who had seen what, you know, African-Americans could do in the air, and not just the Red Tails. Supreme Allied Commander, future President Dwight D. Eisenhower, had taken the first step toward desegregation by sending black soldiers to fight alongside white units during the Battle of the Bulge.
Right. General Eisenhower also recommended to President Truman that he desegregate the armed forces after the war, which Truman did with Executive Order 9981 in 1948. And that's a little bit after the war when you think about it, by the way. Could have happened,
yeah.
you know, day one. But okay, they were happy. That,
right. Well, we'll wait 3 years.
Yeah, they
Why
got
not?
Their chance. Now, keep in mind here, Colonel McGee is speaking in Kansas City, and that's Harry Truman's backyard, of course.
10 months after the Air Force became that separate service, a very courageous president, Harry Truman, I think most of you know him, got lots, But he's that president that said the buck stops here. He's also the president that issued two executive orders that we can all look back and say the experience of the Tuskegee Airmen helped him make those decisions. But he, in Executive Order 9981, mandated that all of the services shall integrate. 9980 said there should also be equal hiring and opportunity throughout the federal government. Both of these coming well ahead of the civil rights action.
Now, Harry Truman might have been the president who dropped the big one, as Archie Bunker liked to say. And
whenever I think of, you know, Archie Bunker in context of the Second World War, there's a great early George Carlin album, Occupation Fool, and he's talking about New York voices in it. And he goes, like, you know, there was the Archie Bunker sort of, you know, voice you'd hear at the bar. He's like, I fought in the big war, the WW2, my friend. It was not a police action. We wanted to go in there. We wanted to go in there and win it, and we won. You know, I don't know what that reminded me of.
So Truman might have dropped the bombs, and Ike might have won the war, but that didn't change hearts and minds overnight, and do they ever, I guess. Yeah. So here's a chapter that those opposed to equal rights tried to erase from the Tuskegee story in the wake of Truman's actions. And I think anybody who grew up in the 80s remembers the movie Top Gun, so let's give a listen.
The Air Force held its first Top Gun gunnery meet in 1949. I think all of you know Top Gun's a big thing in the Air Force, you know, who's the best shooters and all of this. That program's always held out in Arizona. You know, we've got lots of wide open space. Let me jump ahead just a bit. In the 1970s, Air Force history is building, and they began to publish some of their history. And when they started publishing the story of the Top Gun, they had 1949 unknown. Guess who were the Top Guns? Shouldn't be hard for a guess. It was pilots of the 99th of the 332nd Fighter Group flying those P-47Ns. Fortunately, several of the pilots still living had pictures, had their trophies. And by the way, the trophy was found 2 years ago in the basement of the Air Force Museum.
I mean, come on, man. Leave me a little bit of romance left, you know, about the war. But this has to make you wonder, too, just how much history is lost and, you know, how many stories were rewritten or just simply not written at all. And this is, you know, joke about, you know, being called angry history sometimes because we're pretty jovial a lot of the times. But this does make us angry, you know. In centuries past, before audio and video, you know, heroes like this just might have been lost to history forever. Or, on the other hand, their actual accomplishments clouded by myths like we mentioned. They just didn't know who it was. Or, come on.
Yeah, not available. Oh, yeah.
Not available.
They just wanted to go to Europe, seeking not to do any more or any less than any citizen would do. And yet they weren't full citizens in the eyes of the law. They just wanted to fight right. for their country in time of war, do their bit, as Colonel McGee said earlier. And they were only really labeled as civil rights pioneers and as the Tuskegee Airmen after their service captured the popular imagination. So it wasn't as if they started with the book deals and talk about Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, he came home from the war. He was already a hero. I came home. He was a hero. These guys, they went back to their jobs, you know, and there weren't a lot of jobs available. As Colonel McGee said, he wanted to become an airline pilot, but he couldn't because they weren't ready for me. You know, so what did you do? And thank God so many of them did live long enough to be recognized.
Yep. You know, we put names on things. So sometimes you could say, well, when you look back at it, that the Tuskegee Airmen experience was an early civil rights action. But, you know, folks, and some of you in the room may know, and then many of you probably don't know, the attitudes around the country at that time with laws that were on the books in most states and so on felt that any time you get a group of blacks together, there's got to be problems. And the same attitudes that the War College had, that dealing blacks and whites together is a problem. Hopefully you can see that the accomplishment of the Tuskegee Airmen, now called Tuskegee Airmen, why? Because all of our training took place at Tuskegee. We didn't go down as Tuskegee Airmen, but that's a resultant. We like to hang names on things, as I say. That experience proves something. what the Army War College said was a problem, and what they called facts, I put them down as biases, generalizations, and in some cases just outright racism. Were they facts in your mind? When you can look at what the training program produced and what was accomplished during the war years?
And Colonel McGee doesn't see himself as a pioneer. I mean, you know, just like, I guess, in many ways, you know, Rosa Parks, you know, a woman trying to get home from work, didn't see herself as a pioneer until history and circumstance will sometimes thrust you into this position, you know. But anyway, Colonel McGee, he says, quote, "No, we were just young folks eager to be a part of what was going on and be respected for what we were capable of doing and not our happenstance of birth," end quote. Even within the civil rights movement at the time, the service of these pilots wasn't universally applauded.
There were those that wanted integration now. And there were those that said that this action by the Army to only authorize the squadron and locate everything there, that's still discrimination. Well, in a way it was, because we weren't working together as a team of Americans. Well, we've come a long ways.
Again, I think we've said a few times here that there's not a trace of bitterness, and we will post the full interview and the Q&A at angryhistory.com for you to hear. There really is an amazing tone of the guy and how he was feeling at the time, and I guess how else can you be? And that's, I guess, that Boy Scout oath coming through and being an Eagle Scout. But thank God that we're a country that could still produce people like this out there, because we have this legacy of people handing a torch from guys like the Tuskegee Airmen to Americans today that serve.
Yep. And listen, as we start to wrap this up, we have to thank the Kansas City Public Library Central Branch for sharing the audio of this event. And you can enjoy many more programs like this one through them at kclibrary.org. It's great. The idea that Dean and I do this show as a thing of passion, sure, the Kansas City Public Library Central Branch is not rolling in money, but these things are important to retain for all of us and for the generations going forward. You know, we've been a country at war nonstop for quite a long time now, and it's sometimes important to try to slow it down and look back as we look forward.
Definitely. I mean, you have to learn the lessons of history, right? You know, they say if you don't learn them, obviously you repeat them. And if you do learn them, you know, you'll see a lot of other people not learning them. And, you know, here's something where we can, you take hearing this guy and you say, you've got to salute this man and say, you try to be a better person. It makes you want to be a better person. It's so uplifting. And the legacy of the Red Tails does live on in what's now called the 332nd Air Expeditionary Group. A bunch of the Red Tails, including Colonel McGee, went to visit them when they were deployed in Iraq about 10 years ago. It includes men and women of all different backgrounds and races now, of course. Colonel McGee said, quote, "I am proud they're in a unit carrying our name. That's very meaningful from the heritage point of view."
Hey, we hope you enjoyed taking this flight with the Tuskegee Airmen, and that you'll do as Colonel McGee asked in his speech. Please share their story with the young person. You know, as he says, quote, "Our numbers are thinning, but our goal is mentoring our young people to not only know the history, but to challenge them for the future," end quote.
It's a wise advice. I think this is a pretty moving episode. We're really touching a person in history here, a living legend, and may continue to live long. I hope he goes well past 100.
Me too. I'm Owen Moody.
I'm Dean Karyanis. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.
Under the feet of these men, a new road is being beaten out. Broad enough now for thousands and ten thousands. A good road for our country. These men remember that. Marching or flying. They remember backing them up. Their families. Their friends. Who expect so much of them. And backing them up, the men and women of every creed and speech and color who made these planes. And backing them up, the most powerful force in the world, the strength of the American people.
Visit angryhistory.com to learn more about the topics discussed on today's episode. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook, tweet us at Angry History, or send us an email to angry@angryhistory.com.